My name is Andy Cutchins. I'm director and senior fellow at the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And I am very pleased to welcome such a big crowd here today for our discussion of U.S.-Russia relations after PNTR, the long view. We really have a fantastic program. It kind of reminds me when I was a kid, and now I'll really date myself, when with the family we were sitting around the TV on a Sunday night watching the Ed Sullivan show, and he would announce the show and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have a really big shoe tonight," and the Beatles would come on. Okay, it was a long time ago, but it was pretty damn exciting. We don't have the Beatles tonight, and even though the Stones are on tour, we don't have them either. But seriously, we have a terrific program this morning to examine with some of our best thinkers and most experienced policymakers where the U.S.-Russia relationship is going, and indeed Russia itself. This conference culminates a CSIS project that has been co-managed by the Russia and Eurasia Program and the Scholl Chair in International Business, which is run by my colleague Scott Miller. And the idea of the project has been to both facilitate dialogue and mutual understanding between the executive and the legislative branches of U.S. government about the significance of Russia's WTO accession and where economic and commercial ties should fit in the U.S.-Russian bilateral relationship, as well as to provide a forum to look more deeply in a review-like manner of the broader U.S.-Russia relationship. Going back to the spring of this year, we held four dinners, bringing together key executive and legislative branch representatives and experienced outside government experts to explore these issues in considerable depth. And as the keystone of the project, we had envisioned a large public conference on Capitol Hill to bring these issues to a much wider audience and at a propitious moment. And I think we have fulfilled the plan in that the House has passed legislation to grant PNTR status to Russia earlier this month, along with the Magnitsky Act, and the Senate is now deliberating this legislation. And certainly we hope that we don't jinx the prospects for this legislation with the title of the conference, U.S.-Russia Relations After PNTR. Before getting to our first panel, I would like to quickly acknowledge and thank the Business Roundtable and the Boeing Corporation for financial support that made this project possible, and also a special thanks to Speaker Boehner's office for commandeering this beautiful space for us here this morning, and also special thanks to the Director of Congressional Relations at CSIS, Louis Lauder, who is our guru, and without him and his crack staff, none of this would have happened. The plan today is to break up into two panels or discussions. In the first session, we'll focus more closely on the economic and commercial relationship between the United States and Russia and its potential. And undoubtedly, a number of other issues will enter this conversation, such as governance, rule of law issues, and domestic Russian politics, perhaps as well. The second half of the program will focus more on foreign security policy challenges and opportunities and challenges that Russia presents to U.S. foreign policy. So, with no further ado, let me turn the floor over to my colleague, Scott Miller, who will introduce our distinguished panelists and moderate the first session.
Thank you, Andy. And let me extend my welcome to you this morning. I'm joined by two experts in Russia and international trade. I'm delighted to be part of this program. Representative Adam Smith represents the Washington's 9th Congressional District, which is basically the South Puget Sound region, runs from roughly Olympia to Tacoma. You have a slightly new district now with
a very new district,
Washington adding a seat post the 2010 census. He's the ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee. Despite Representative Smith's relative youth, he has an extensive career in public service. For those of you in the room who are overachievers, I want to let you know he was a state senator at age 25. He's now in his 8th term in Congress and just reelected to a 9th term in his new district by over 70% of the vote, so he's doing something right. I've had the privilege of working with Congressman Smith over the years on a number of issues, and I've always found him to be the consummate, fair, even-handed listener. He has excellent judgment, and thanks for one of the reasons he's on today's panel is he has superb insight into national security issues from his experience on the Armed Services Committee. Also, we have welcome Ambassador Carla Hills. Ambassador Hills is chairman and chief executive officer of Hills & Company, an international consultancy. She was the United States Trade Representative from 1989 to 1993, member of the President George H.W. Bush's cabinet, the principal advisor on trade and investment issues to the President, and the nation's lead negotiator. Under her watch, she crafted a number of landmark agreements, including the Uruguay round to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which led to the formation of the WTO, and the North American Free Trade Agreement. Ambassador Hill serves on a number of corporate boards, as well as investing a lot of her time in public policy organizations. Most importantly, she's a trustee of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Ambassador Hill is well known to this room, and in fact, in Washington, has a very large fan club, of which I am personally proud to be a member. She can be counted upon for wise counsel, creative approaches to commercial diplomacy in all sorts of situations, and a genuinely optimistic spirit. The glass is always half full with Ambassador Hill. So we'll welcome both of you, and Congressman Smith, I'd like to turn to you first for opening remarks. A couple of months ago, you made a speech at the Center for American Progress, and you opened with a remark that stuck with me, which is that the world is a better place and our national security interests are advanced when we can find ways to work with Russia. Could you talk about how the commercial engagement factor plays into that role of working with Russia?
Well, certainly. I think, first of all, the overarching point is, you know, looking at the world as sort of multipolar to some mm-hmm. extent now. There are a lot of centers of power, and I think the secret to the U.S. best advancing our interests and best advancing global stability is to figure out how to work with those different entities. I mean, we have our interests, and we will not be shy about pursuing them. But given the diversity in the world right now in the economy, and the notion that we can simply force our way on the world, if it was ever true, certainly isn't true now. And you can see a lot of the different power centers that are rising. China's the obvious one, but also India, Brazil, you know, European Union is still an important group, and Russia is one of those. So when you look at the global challenges that we face, you know, you can think of a number of different issues where if Russia is working with us, we're in a better place. The most obvious one is non-proliferation work that we've done. You know, we're in a bit of a bad spot on that right at the moment as the law that was put in place to, you know, give us the ability to work with them and, you know, send some money to Russia to work with them to stop, to get better control of the nuclear materials expired, right. And we're trying to work. But we can do that, you know, in Afghanistan, huge challenges. Russia, regrettably, has a great deal of experience down there. And dealing with the larger counterterrorism problem, they have mm-hmm. that as well. There's a whole lot of different areas that we can work with them if we can find a way to connect. Now, the problem is there's also a great deal of animosity between Russia and the U.S., both historically and currently. I mean, Russia thinks of itself as a great power, and to a certain degree, to the extent that we're more powerful, that undermines that. So there's sort of just a basic psychological rivalry there in whatever we do that we have to get past. So whenever you're in a situation like that, it's always best to sort of look for the areas where you can get along. Political analogy, obviously, if you have groups who are, you know, that you know you're not going to be with on crucial issues, my philosophy has always been, well, let's sit down, is there something we can agree on, you know, mm-hmm. rather than just saying, well, let's focus on this and just beat each other's brains out for a while, let's go through everything you're interested in and see if we can find something, and that's where economics comes in, and that's why it's so important that we get PNTR put in place. It puts us in a position to begin to develop that economic relationship, and economically, it can be mutually beneficial. Now, there's a number of challenges there, and Ambassador Hills, I think, probably knows this better than I. You know, Russia's economy is not run the same way that ours is. When you're looking for transparency, when you're looking for, gosh, everything from, intellectual property to financial services, you name it, we are going to have to work really hard to develop the rules to make that an opportunity. But look, Russia's a growing economy. There's, you know, a ton of economic opportunity there. We ought to be able to access those markets. This gives us the chance to move forward. And if we access those markets, if we develop a better economic relationship, then a lot of these other issues are easier. Not easy, not necessarily done. It's like, you know, Tom Friedman's old adage about no two countries that both have McDonald's have ever gone to war. I don't know if that's even still true. That was in the 1990s. I'd have to go through and check that off. But his point was, the more you have in common, the less likely you are to have conflict. And mm-hmm. economics is where I think we can work to develop some of those commonalities with Russia. The challenges are not insignificant, working out the details.
Thank you. Ambassador Hills, let me turn to you. You've been a tireless advocate of economic reform. And while it took Russia 18 years to join the WTO, at the end of the day, many have concluded the reformers won. They won the argument. What are your views about U.S.-Russia relations post-PNTR and how we can take advantage of the fact that reformers came through in the end with this accession package?
We have a long way to go with Russia. It has high barriers. It is quite opaque. And rule of law is not up to our standards. But having them become the last of the G20 to join the World Trade Organization is definitely a benefit to the United States. And we should not let it pass by. First of all, there are the economic benefits. Across the board, the accession agreement that Russia's entered into will cut their tariffs by roughly 25%. 1,000 pages of tariffs is quite a restricted market. It will open up services, particularly financial, entertainment, and telecommunication services, which are areas of U.S. strength. They will end some restrictive licensing, like on the encryption of software. And they'll adopt sanitary and phytosanitary measures on farm products. And we export a lot of farm products. So this will be a benefit for our entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And the assessment, the Peterson Institute has done an assessment that says that our $11 billion worth of trade over the next 5 years will double. Ed Gresher of the Progressive Economy says, no, it'll be much greater than that. It'll triple. And he does the historic analysis that shows that our trade normally with a normal WTO new member grows twice as fast as our exports to a new free trade member in a bilateral or plurilateral meeting, and three times faster than our trade with the rest of the economy. But I think in addition to the economic benefits, I always call them the mercantile benefits, it is the side effects of clarity. The fact that, you know, it took 18 years for Russia to negotiate its accession agreement because it had to negotiate with 156 nations. It had to ensure that its trade rules met the standards of the WTO and in many, many respects. And so there are changes. Some of them will be gradual over time. But that clarity and transparency is something that will also benefit Russia. And rule of law. There's no question that two of the mandates of the World Trade Organization are non-discrimination, that is, exports from nations that come in have to be treated evenly, and national treatment. You can't treat your own product, your own entrepreneurs better than those who are importing or doing business with you. That equality will also enhance rule of law. So I look forward to Russia, as other members who have joined the WTO, of moving in a positive way, in our opinion, on their economic regime, both domestically and internationally. And that will be a huge benefit, that we get clarity, economic benefits, rule of law, transparency, and I hope that we can move forward on it. I'm frankly concerned that we haven't move forward, because we won't get these benefits unless we pass the bill giving Russia permanent normal trade relations, which means that we have to repeal a Cold War relic, the Jackson-Vanik Amendment that was passed in 1974. We were concerned then that Russia prohibited the immigration of its Jewish citizens, and that doesn't exist anymore. So to have our economic and, as the congressman said, our strategic relationship hampered by a rule of the past that is no longer applicable just doesn't make any sense from our own interests.
Thank you. Just a final point on emigration from Russia. As I understand it, there is a daily nonstop flight between Moscow and Tel Aviv. So I think we're over that particular issue. But in any case,
we're better tell the Senate.
Yeah. Yeah, the House has actually done its work and done it in a strong bipartisan manner with an overwhelming vote in favor of extending permanent normal trade with Russia. So Congressman Smith, thank you for your leadership on that. We'd like to turn to questions, and I'll move quickly to your questions, but let me start with a question about the real winner in the in the permanent normal trade relations and the entrance of the WTO, which is the Russian consumer. Many American companies have been doing business in Russia for some time now, and one of the reasons to do business in Russia is the Russian consumer is very savvy. They're well-educated. They're demanding. They are critically evaluating the products, and they see benefits like value and quality that may come from years of buying Soviet products. But wherever it comes from, the Russian consumers are demanding a very high quality and very loyal to brands. That's a good thing, but you know, this demanding better has occasionally led to some protests of government action. Recall a couple of years back, Russia restricted the importation of a certain quantity of foreign automobiles. And they actually, the Russian consumers reacted with significant intensity that Russia later backed down on the measure. So given the new rules and given that the consumer is the winner in all this, how do you think this consumer sovereignty among the Russian people will affect both our geopolitical relations and our economic relations? Either one of you.
Well, I actually think that that this measure will cause the Russian economy to grow, and greater consumption is one of the fires that cause economies to grow. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get China, for example, to stimulate their consumption. And Russia is a major purchaser of products from the United States. Both agriculture is the second largest consumer of beef, poultry, and pork. And it's opened up markets like aircraft and heavy equipment, and that will be quite beneficial mm-hmm. to ours. And the fact that we will be selling to the consumers and our entrepreneurs will be doing business in Russia is really a good thing for the consumers, for the Russian system, because when Americans invest or do business in another country, they bring their values. They create commercial relationships which cushion the problems that can erupt in another realm, as the congressman has said. And so I see this as a big benefit for Russia. It will have lots less restrictions, much more transparency, better rule of law, and that will be constructive. It's a win-win.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree, essentially, yeah.
Let me then ask a brief follow-up, which is I would note that the PricewaterhouseCoopers recently ran a survey among young Russian college graduates. And they were asked of their opinions of American versus Russian companies. And to no American company's surprise, the American companies were very favorably viewed by young, well-educated Russians. They're seen as places to go develop your career, working environments that were both fair and focused on employee development. They liked the standards of professionalism and the standards of ethics that were applied with American companies. It was quite a striking difference. And gave a lot of us who work with American businesses in Russia hope for that the young people really see a better way of doing business. What's your sense of the role that commercial diplomacy through American businesses engaged in Russia plays in our overall strategy?
Well, I think it's absolutely critical for the reasons that you both have stated, that it builds the relationship, that you become more connected. And I think that has a broad impact on all manner of different decisions mm-hmm. that Russia's going to make. And definitely helps us in our security interests, our regional interests. It builds a stronger relationship with Russia, and I think it's a huge opportunity for us economically. It's the basic trade argument that 95% of the world, the people in the world live someplace other than the United States. We're currently responsible for about 20% of global consumption. If we're going to grow, we're going to have to get access to other markets. Well, Russia is one massive market with an improving economy. And the brand loyalty that you mentioned mm-hmm. is so critical.
Right.
That was the advantage we had, in the 50s and 60s, post-World War II. It's a little bit wrong to say we had no competition. We had virtually no competition. And so our brands were able to get into the emerging markets, and people bought Coke and Pepsi and Hewlett-Packard and on, because that's what was there, and they knew it, and they liked it. We have more competition now.
Yes.
But I think also, and this is the shift over to sort of an optimistic take on the U.S. economy. When you look at the challenges of the global economy that we're all very concerned about, the increased competition, nobody is really better positioned, I think, to take advantage of that than we are, because it's not so much anymore about labor costs. It's not about, you know, chasing the cheapest place that you can build something. It's part of it, but a much bigger part now is how good is your product? How good is your brand loyalty? And if you can specialize in a given area. And I tell you, I've had the opportunity in the last year to travel all over the U.S. visiting manufacturers in the defense industry. Mm-hmm. Since I became ranking member, got out, did more of that to sort of go see the tanks and ships and everything that's built. And every place I go, you know, from the top management down to the line worker, everyone's talking about, here's what we're doing to make this work better.
Yes.
Here's what we figured out that makes us be able to produce two of these instead of one. Here's how we have built more loyalty amongst our workers. And we are really focused on improving that. And I think the opportunity to compete in Russia will give us a real opportunity to develop that brand loyalty. And then the other side of that is competition works. And, you know, one of the big struggles with the Russian economy, as Carl explained, is, you know, they got some transparency issues. Let's just put it that way. rule of law, to an understatement. And now if they have to compete, they have to change.
Right.
Because, you know, their consumers don't have to buy it just because it's the only thing on the shelf.
Right.
And I think it's, you know, sort of the ultimate Cold War revenge. I mean, that was always the joke that we won the Cold War basically by, you know, here's your grocery store, here's our grocery store, we win.
That's right.
And, you know, now they're getting, we'll get more of an opportunity to experience that and take advantage of it.
Great. Thank you. Congressman Smith has to catch a plane back to the West Coast, but we have some time for questions from the floor. I wanted to turn to that early. If you have a question, please come up to the center microphone. We're broadcasting this via the webcam and other media. So please make yourself known. If somebody has a question, please come up. Yes, yes, sir. Please introduce yourself and speak into the microphone, and I'll give you the Alex Trebek rule. Make sure it's in the form of a question.
Okay. I'm Mark. I'm with the Overseas Private Investment Corp. You might know we have a major portfolio in Russia, and with the recent ouster of USAID, we're talking about economic issues with Russia. What does that mean going forward for the U.S. development community? As you know, USAID and the Overseas Private Investment Corp. Have worked a lot in the past in Russia, and so what does this mean for OPIC? What does this mean for Millennium Challenge Corporation? What does this mean for further development in Russia? Thanks.
Well, I mean, my sense is it's not a huge impact. I mean, to a certain degree, it's an evolution of the Russian economy to the point where we're going to be working with them on more commercial and business relationships and less on pure development. I mean, USAID is, you know, primarily focused on underdeveloped parts of the world and figuring out how to work with them on a bunch of different projects and move forward. I think it's just a statement by Russia that, you know, we're a modern economy now. You know, our relationship with the U.S. is going to be different. It's going to be more business-based and more commercial-based. I certainly think, you know, OPIC is in a slightly different lane, and that will continue. That's a different set of issues that we should be able to work on. Now the downside is, as I've been talking all through here, you know, the more you work together, the more likely you are to be friendly. Well, this is one place where we're not going to be working together as much as we used to. But there are other places, I think, that we can easily pick up that slack with basic business-to-business commercial relationships that can make up for whatever we've lost in the USAID relationship.
I would only add to that there are tremendous infrastructure needs in Russia. It's a country of nine, it covers nine time zones, and a recent report said there are fewer miles of paved road in Russia today than there were 10 years ago. So there's some tremendous challenges, and you know, if you're reaching all the people of Russia, you have tremendous distances to cover and tremendous infrastructure needs. At the same time, there's also some very important joint ventures. I think Congressman Kevin Brady mentioned that one of Texas' biggest export markets right at the moment is Russia for energy services equipment, energy services technology and equipment. So there will be continued opportunities. I think it's probably, the Congressman is absolutely right, it's more OPIC and XM than it is USAID. So, yes, ma'am.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rosemary Seguero. I'm the president of Seguero's International Group. I'm based here in Washington, D.C. I'm a woman entrepreneur. My brother went to school in China. My son went to college in China. And as a woman entrepreneur, how do you look at women doing business? Because doing business in Russia is not so easy with women. How do we penetrate into that big business or doing business in China? Thank you.
How do you look at what?
Women doing business in Russia, like China.
The question is specifically about women doing business in Russia and the difficulty of that. I'm not that familiar with in Russia how many business people are women. It doesn't strike me as that it's a lot at first glance. So I think that's going to be a challenge. I mean, there are cultural challenges in every country that we go in to do businesses, and certainly sexism is one of them. How do you overcome that? Well, I think you start to overcome that by having the possibility of a business relationship, and that's what PNTR does. And again, that exposes Russia to the outside world, because what they will find is if they have a sexist approach to who they're going to do business with, they will not be very successful for very long. They will be placing themselves at a disadvantage. And in a competitive environment, you have a lot tougher time getting away with that disadvantage than you do in a closed economy. So I think that will help. I don't have specific insights beyond that, but I think it will certainly help put more pressure on them to open up.
It's one of the reasons American companies are favored by young Russian graduates, both male and female, is because we look at talent differently. I would also note that my previous employer for a long period of time was Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble's president in Russia is a woman. In fact, she is a Peruvian woman and is doing a great job, mainly because our company mainly sells to women. And there are a lot of companies who sell primarily to women where there's real added value of having women executives. So.
And that's a very good example of Americans bringing their values to the countries where they are doing business. You'll find that large companies, Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, mm-hmm. bring their values to a place like Russia. And so discrimination and those kinds of things just don't play, and it's contagious, so that we've had a positive effect where we've done business in countries that have been quite restrictive of various rights and opportunities. I'm not saying that Russia is going to change overnight. It has high barriers, and although it's going to cut its tariffs by 25%, still they'll be in the range of 10%, 10 to 12%. And the clarity of their rules is going to take time for their laws to be made just the way we would write them. But we're definitely moving in the right direction.
Next question. Yes, sir.
Mike Macedic with the PBS Online News Hour. Several of you have referred delicately to the rule of law. To what extent is this change going to affect American companies doing business in a country where the mob has a heavy influence, politicians siphon billions of dollars off to Swiss bank accounts, and if you challenge the authority of the people in charge too much, you're likely to end up dead?
Well, my sense is you're not going to fix that overnight any more than when China came into the WTO. I mean, China, it's intellectual property, all kinds of problems, and it's been 12 years now, I think, thereabouts, since we got China in. There's problems still exist. It has gotten better, I believe, and at least now you have a forum to go to if you are a foreign investor. If you experience any of those things that you just described. Now, Russia's going to have to make some internal decisions to change that to improve their economy. Because in a global economy, if you are hostile to foreign investment, if foreign investors are coming in thinking, I really don't want to come into a mob war, that's not my idea of doing business, then that is going to hurt your domestic economy. Now, that's true now, even with Russia not being in the WTO, and they have been unable to fix the problems. But what the WTO does is at least gives you a place to go and a place to file complaints. The U.S. can do it. Individual businesses can do it. So it helps. But, yes, I think you point out why, as both Carl and I said in our opening remarks, this is a great step, moves us in a positive direction, but we shouldn't have any illusions that the Russian economy is suddenly going to open up as a result of being part of the WTO. That's a gradual process. But the one thing I will say, they are far more likely to move in a positive direction in the WTO than outside of it.
I think that the fact that they're required to have transparency so you know what the rules are, the fact that non-discrimination is a major issue that they have to abide by, and as the congressman said, where you have a dispute, you now have the most respected international organization to decide who's right and who's wrong, and it makes a difference and it reduces friction. I frankly think that by stimulating the economy in Russia and having Russia reduce its trade barriers, it will be contagious to its economic economy and to its approach to economic issues. So no, it's not going to be a miraculous transformation, but as I said earlier, it's moving us in the right direction.
There's a long record of American companies being in full compliance with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. That makes a difference when you operate in any foreign market, because the message to officials when it comes to things like corruption is don't ask for a bribe because we're not going to pay it. It's illegal for us to pay it. And it's actually a good stance, a positive stance. In many cases, while there is corruption in the Russian market, it's often the capriciousness rather than the corruption that creates the business problems. Ambassador Hill's alluded to this. Occasionally a regulation would be proposed one day and implemented the next with no real thought about how to do that. This is where the transparency and the rules of the trading system will benefit participants in the market. And it's not just the foreign importers who will benefit. It's all the commercial entities in the market will benefit from a more open and a more predictable business environment. It won't cure corruption overnight. Nothing in fact does. But I think most American businesses are looking forward to an environment where there's a greater degree of predictability in the regulatory regimes. Thank you for your question. Is there one final question? The Congressman is almost out of time. Yes, sir.
Andrew Wilson from the Center for International Private Enterprise. You know, the opening of markets in Russia that will go to WTO place a great opportunity for American companies both to develop their supply chains and distribution chains, but the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act also places a great burden on them to ensure that that any third parties they're working with in Russia
yes.
are in compliance with U.S. anti-corruption standards and ethical standards. What do you think both the U.S. private sector and the public sector can do to encourage the development of greater standards in Russia along those lines so American companies can have a more, as you say, predictable and ethical business environment with which to work?
Well, I think the business communities that we have are always constructive when they reach out and try to help American businesses be more effective. If I got the tenor of your question, it was what can associations like the Business Roundtable, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Chambers of Commerce in Russia, the various groups, they can all be constructive. You know, transparency is important, but they can help make the rules, let the rules be known, and they can show where there are conflicts or and speak out against the kind of conflicts that Scott has alluded to. There's a host of things that they can do to facilitate a more harmonious conduct of business, and they're doing that around the world. They're certainly doing that if you go to China and go to the Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai. They're extremely helpful for U.S. businesses yes. doing business in China. So I think opening the door here, creating transparency and clarity, requiring Russia to abide by certain rules. I'm talking about rules like intellectual property protection, trade-related investment measures, a host of rules that were a condition precedent to their being admitted into this club of 157 members of the World Trade Organization. They get the benefits of getting, I think, a stimulation to their economy, more investment, which will create jobs, and the clarity of rules will generate growth, and they have a place to go if they think that they are right and another member has done something that violates the World Trade Organization's basic rules. They have a place to go, not just complain about it or send security squabs out to deal with it,
right.
but they have a forum, a legal forum to go to and make their case.
I think the ambassador is exactly right. I would only add to that that Russia is joining the World Trade Organization for its own interests.
Right.
Okay? Which means there is a notion within the Russian government that economic reform is an important agenda. The other thing that is part of the Russian agenda that I sensed in following this for the past several years has been Russia looking for respect from the international community. And one of the reasons, it's important that this huge economy, 11th largest economy in the world, is not a member of the trading system and now is. That's a huge benefit to Russia in terms of the international respect accorded. Likewise, Russia is very interested in being a part of an organization like the OECD, which has even higher standards. And I would note on the specific issue of corruption and bribery, Russia adopted the OECD understanding on bribery and corruption with public officials. So they adopted the standard. Now, whether or not it's going to be implemented properly, we'll see how that works out over the years. But there is an impetus within the Russian government because of their own interests that I think has led to according higher respect to their intentions. And I think that will benefit all entrepreneurs and certainly both governments in the long term.
Let me just close, and then I do have to run by saying that I think that's the greatest point. Russia wants to be respected more than anything.
Yes.
They view themselves as a great power in the world, and they want that respect. Oftentimes, they have an odd way of showing it.
Yeah.
But you know, part of that, they have to kind of you have to be part of the international community of nations in the modern world if you are going to be respected. Now, definitely they want to do their own thing, but I think the tension there is they've got to move into the community of nations if they're going to be respected as the great power that they want to be, and this is an opportunity for them to move in the right direction. So hopefully they will take full advantage of it, but we'll see.
Thank you, and please join me in thanking the Congressman and the Ambassador.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second part of our program, and this is a tremendous personal and professional honor for me to have the opportunity to introduce Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski and have a discussion with him about Russia. Dr. Brzezinski has been a role model personally for me ever since I was in college, and you were a national security advisor to the Carter administration and doing incredibly important things like the normalization of relations with China and the Panama Canal Treaty and a number of other things. But Dr. Brzezinski is someone who has achieved the highest level of achievement, really, both in academia and international relations, as well as a practitioner in international politics himself. And he's also somebody that has been very independent and very bipartisan. You were an advisor.
Well, scientists like me.
Sorry? Well, creates lots of friends and some enemies perhaps as well. His publishing record is a really extraordinary, you know, from his first book, The Soviet Bloc, Unity and Discord, a real masterpiece in Sovietology, and to his most recent book, entitled Strategic Vision, American and the Crisis of Global Power. All of his writings are tremendously incisive and eloquent, and Zbig also has the amazing ability to speak as well as even perhaps better sometimes than you write. You someone that speaks in paragraphs. So formally right now, Dr. Brzezinski is a counselor and trustee, and co-chairs the CSIS Advisory Board with Ambassador Carla Hills, that was just with us, and is also a professor of American Foreign Policy at the Paul Nitzis School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington, D.C. Zbig, it's great to have you here with us today to talk about Russia.
Well, thank you very much, Andy, and particularly for that very, very restrained introduction. I appreciate it.
It's hard for me. Well, let me ask you some questions. Let's start with the U.S.-Russia relationship. You know, President Clinton, President George W. Bush, they both had some initial success with Russia earlier in their terms, and then things didn't go so well. I think President Obama, with the reset, together with President Medvedev achieved a number of important agreements that served the interests of both the United States and the Russian Federation, but the relationship seems to have gone a bit more roughly in the last year and a half. What do you see a similarity in the dynamics of over these different administrations in U.S.-Russia relations over the last 20 years? And how would you, what would you advise President Obama as to how to avoid the kind of the downward spiral that his predecessors experienced with his colleagues in Moscow?
Well, I think we have to add one more name to the list of names that you've mentioned, and that's Putin. I think the fact of the matter is that for the United States, the Soviet Union no longer exists, and Russia is not perceived as an enemy. There are problems with Russia in our perspective on the relationship, but these problems are not problems that stem from a relationship, from our point of view, of strategic hostility or historical enmity. I'm not quite convinced that that is also the case on the other side, and particularly with Putin. I think Putin is, to some extent, a self-imposed prisoner of imperial nostalgia. He seems to be committed to the idea that somehow or other the greatness of Russia is dependent on the degree to which Moscow can revitalize, revive, and reimpose a hegemonic relationship on a space that he now openly declares to be Euro-Asian and thereby overlapping with the borders of the former Soviet Empire or Imperial Empire. I think that is a serious problem. It's a problem of vision and historical direction. And it has a lot of connections, in my judgment, with the self-evident difficulties internally that Russia now confronts. Because these difficulties, in many respects, stem from the fact that with this kind of an outlook, and with this kind of priorities in mind, it is very difficult for Russia to address some of the internal problems that it is facing, and it is facing with increasing severity. So my perspective on the relationship in the longer historical run is optimistic, because I think Russia is changing, in spite of Putin, but not thanks to Putin. And after Putin is no longer on the scene, that process, I think, will accelerate. Now, how long he will be on the scene, I cannot speculate, but I do sense this growing sense of frustration and malaise within Russia. And then I have this strange and very subjective, and it shouldn't be taken seriously, personal foreboding regarding Putin himself. I think there's something ailing him, maybe literally, maybe figuratively for sure, but maybe actually literally. He just doesn't seem to me to be anymore the kind of self-confident, energetic, very deliberately and exaggeratedly so youthful leader, which he's no longer, although Botox can help for a while. But other than that, there is kind of a sense there's something troubling him, and we'll know presumably before too long.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. As you know, I've been part of this Valdai discussion club that meets with Putin and Russian elites every year. And we had the most recent meeting in late October, just a little bit more than a month ago. And my impression of Putin in this meeting, and this is very personal and subjective as well, is that he seemed somewhat more disengaged. There seemed to be not necessarily a lethargy, but not a real kind of positive energy. He didn't seem to be actually as in command of some facts and figures, which he normally is, very much in his portfolio. And he certainly, when given the opportunity to kind of talk about, you know, what is your vision for what, you know, you've, the question was put to him actually by former German defense minister Volker Rühe. You know, you've had a number of achievements in the first 8 or 12 years in de facto powers, you consider it. Look at the economic growth, et cetera, and stabilization of society. But what do you want really to be your legacy? And he completely punted on the question. Didn't seem clear that he's clear about that.
You know, there's something beyond that which may be very personal, but I see kind of a strange, shift from a person who was always tempted to engage in dramatic activity to the point of it eventually becoming comical, like the flight with the cranes, now to a person who has some difficulty standing up, who looks kind of deflated. If you look at the pictures, he doesn't look quite as vigorous and youthful as he was until recently. All of that seems to be part of this larger, maybe, dilemma of what is happening in Russia today. I think more and more Russians, in any case, are beginning to be aware of the fact that they are no longer guided by a formula which can assure Russia's preeminence on the world scene, and more preoccupied with the uncertainties that this implies.
Well, let's get back to the challenges that the Obama administration faces now. Will be launching a second term with Russia. I think the point you make that I think the values gap, so-called values gap at the societal level, I think is diminishing, and I think that's part of what we saw with the reaction to the falsification, the problems with the parliamentary elections last year, and the tens and even hundreds of thousands of Russians that came into the street. Russian society is not the same Russian society today that when Vladimir Putin came to power 12 years ago. But so maybe at a societal level, there is a convergence to some extent.
With what?
Well, levels of economic growth. I mean, Russia is kind of following the path of what we'd expect with modernization theory. You're seeing people with a higher per capita income becoming more demanding of better governance, some degree of pluralism. I mean, this was the first social mobilization of political opposition that we've seen in 20 years there. And then on the other hand, though, you see his reaction, the leadership's reaction, to push back quite hard against this this group. And yet we have an agenda with Russia that we need to, some issues that we need to work with them on. How do we approach a leader like this at this time?
Well, we certainly approach it on the basis of those issues of national interest to us, which are subject to accommodation with them, and we engage in discussions and negotiations with them so that they are resolved. I don't think one can entertain any sort of grand notion right now of a historical resolution of past dilemmas and joint embrace. I think that is not in the cards, and even the word reset doesn't imply that. Reset has, to some extent, a narrowly defined scope by implication. You're just resetting something. But I think the more basic issue that we face in Russia is the contradictory trend, as I see it, in two significant social momentums. One is the emphasis and the awakening and the stimulation of an intense and sometimes narrow-minded nationalism. And you see that occasionally on the streets, in the demonstrations, but also in the rhetoric to which Putin, to some extent himself, is susceptible. And it does pertain to a significant portion of the Russian population, particularly outside of the most important cities. And this surge in Russian nationalism is, to some extent, an understandable phenomenon. You know, for 60 years, Russia didn't even appear on the map, so to speak, officially. The Soviet Union was a union of socialist Soviet republics. But Russia was not a republic in it, even though Russia was dominating it ethnically. And now there is this surge of nationalism, which can be quite primitive in some respects, and assertive, and in some instances perhaps even dangerous, although I don't want to overstate that. But in any case, it's also connected with a kind of an authoritarian instincts. But on the other hand, there is the emergence of a new middle class, particularly again in the big cities, whereas the other one is more associated with the less immediately big cities. And this new middle class is increasingly cosmopolitan, internationally minded, exposed to the world, open to the world, in contact with the world by the internet, not to mention many of them study abroad, quite a few choose to have also alternative residences abroad, and a number of the top echelons in that class deposit their money abroad. That explains the capital flight. I think these two trends are kind of antipathetic to each other. In the short run, the first trend probably provides some of the social and political momentum for such ideas as the Eurasian Union. But then, of course, at some point before too long, the question will arise, who wants to join the Eurasian Union? I don't see too many candidates eager for membership. Kazakhstan under Nazarbayev, very doubtful. He's maneuvering very well between Russia and China, and at the same time reaching to the outside world. Karimov in Uzbekistan? Oh, much less. Karimov is much more nationalistic. The Uzbeks are much more assertive about their national independence. Well then, what about Yanukovych? There was a chance, a very promising chance. But it turned out that Yanukovych and his, so to speak, sponsors, financial sponsors, are more interested in identifying their own territory. The way, for example, sometimes criminal gangs divide territory. And they don't want other criminal gangs to move in on their territory. So they're in effect saying to the Russians, well, we're going to be with you, but this is our territory. We are the ones who have an exclusive right to steal and cheat in this area. That's ours. Now you do your act in yours, but not in ours. And that sort of defines the context for some of the discussions between Yanukovych and the Putin regime. Lukashenko, well, to some extent similar, although he probably is in the long run more vulnerable. Maybe there is going to be an opportunity now in Georgia that has to be watched very carefully, because that could become a friction point with the United States because of the importance of the Baku-Chekhine line. But those are the kind of issues which arise out of that particular outlook. But the other outlook is one which recognizes that for Russia to thrive, it has to be associated with the West increasingly. Otherwise, the China threat looms large. For Russia to thrive, Russia has to be a more open, creative democracy. And that point of view is becoming more pervasive with that other social development. And I think that one will come to the fore sometime after Putin is gone. Now, we don't know when he'll go. And we can't predict how long it'll be after, but it'll be after Putin. And I, therefore, entertain on that basis what might be called a kind of historical optimism, perhaps naive in some respects, but hopeful, because I can see great prospects for Russia if that happens. Russia would have a lot to contribute to the West, and Russia would benefit enormously, decisively, in fact, from a closer association with the West. In the absence of it, I think it will essentially stagnate. And, you know, a country in which GDP is roughly 2 to 3% of the global GDP is not a major world power.
Well, in a sense, you've just answered my next question, whether what we're seeing right now, during the Putin period, this emphasis on hyper-sovereignty and on Russia's independence, and not aligning itself either way, was a sustainable foreign policy course in the longer term. I think clearly the answer from your standpoint is not. It is not. But it's not clear how the change will come about and when it'll come about. Now, at this point, there is some interesting things happening, I think, from Russian foreign policy in Asia. I think some have said that Russia, maybe Putin's biggest challenge is going to be managing his relationship with China. if we're looking at a 6 to 12 year window. What would you be advising? I know this is a rather presumptuous question, but how would you, if you were sitting in the Kremlin, how would you think about your Asia policy and how would you manage it?
Well, I might be initially tempted to try to exploit some of the frictions that have lately developed between the United States and China. And I personally feel that we are partially responsible for some of those frictions. But that's neither here nor there. The Chinese also have their share of responsibility for some of these frictions. My hope is, of course, that after the new leadership in China settles in, after we get our foreign policy administration organized, that it will address this issue significantly, because it is in the vital interest, both of America and of China, to contain these frictions and to avoid their escalation. But if I were sitting in the Kremlin right now, I might be somewhat tempted to see if there is a possibility to exploit them. But if you begin to look at that quote-unquote opportunity more closely, it becomes clear that it's a very narrow opportunity. The Russians can't help the Chinese very much in their frictions with us. Perhaps they would welcome some Russian support on some issues, but by and large, they're really not dependent on it. And to the extent that the Chinese were to choose pursuing the frictions, they have the capability in some cases to assert their interests. In other cases, perhaps suffer some negative consequences from doing so. But it'll be their mistakes to make. And they're not dependent here, I think, on Russian assistance. So I think in the limited opportunity that perhaps today exists, there isn't too much longer range positive strategic opportunity for Russia. In the longer run, I think the fundamental question is whether Russia succeeds in regaining genuine momentum in its internal development and growth and modernization. Unfortunately, the Russian economy has been sliding increasingly into a pattern which in a number of respects is similar to that of the Nigerian economy. Dependence on a single source of income, tremendous corruption, and economically costly corruption, capital flight, and so forth and so forth. Well, that is something that will be particularly dangerous to Russia in terms of its relationship with China. If China retains its own historical, political, economic momentum, keeps developing, and in the meantime, the population of the Russian Far East gradually continues to decline, as it has been. It is no longer being subsidized the way it was understood. That, to the Russians, is a very understandable source of concern. But then how should they deal with it? And here I come back to what I was saying earlier, namely, if Russia moves to the West under the increasing cover of a more assertive Western-oriented Russian middle class, Russia has a far greater opportunity for regaining momentum in the development of its presence in the Far East together with the West. In my book on the strategic vision, I sort of make a passing reference to Vladivostok, how in that context it could become simultaneously a cosmopolitan city full of Europeans who see an opportunity for themselves in that new, highly developing area, if it becomes one, but still a Russian city within the Russian sovereign territories. And that, I think, is the best outcome for Russia. A Russia that's Western-oriented and capitalizes on that opportunity. But that will take democracy. That will take the new middle class becoming politically dominant. And we aren't there yet, and there's been some retrogression.
Well, I think this is, you put your finger on what to me is Putin's biggest challenge, and it's kind of a paradox in that, I mean, he is popular principally because of the economic growth and prosperity that Russia has experienced over the time that he's been in power. And I think he knows that. But the consequences of that economic growth and prosperity has been the development of this middle class, of a more cosmopolitan-oriented significant part of the population that gets their news from the internet, that is much more independent, less dependent upon state enterprises and subsidies from the state, et cetera, et cetera. And they are, you know, assuming economic growth continues, this group is growing larger. And at some time, they are going to be the majority. Now, whether that's going to happen in 5 or 7 or 10 years is hard to say. But, you know, the sources that drove Russian economic growth for much of the last 10, 12 years, well, it's been the oil price increase. It's been the increase in oil production that the Russians experienced in the first 4 years or so that Putin was in power. Relatively easy monetary conditions around the world that existed until recently. You know, all of those things are not likely to be there, or at least to the level that they were all together for the first 8 or 10 years that Putin has been in power. So to promote the growth on which his popularity is dependent, he has to look to new drivers. And I think there that gets back to the economic and political reform agenda for greater efficiencies, et cetera, et cetera. But that's a big thing to ask of a leader, to fundamentally change course. But if he doesn't fundamentally change course, it seems that his political prospects, you know, are going to be shorter term than longer term.
Well, that's exactly what I was saying, yeah. Exactly. And therefore, that's not a very attractive prospect for him. And there is, I think, a potential problem here, namely that at this stage, there isn't really a clear definition of an appealing alternative to him. The things that I was talking about, the things that you have been talking about, are kind of broad socioeconomic demographic trends. But they haven't yet crystallized into political orientations and political leaders with really significant potential appeal. So I don't expect that change to take place too soon. And it's even not a foregone conclusion that it'll necessarily be all that stable,
yeah,
or even avoid retrogression of some sort under the nationalist flag. Because at least that element is passionate and purposive and probably potentially very ruthless if it came to power.
Let's look at an issue that is going to be, again, facing the next Obama administration. One of their big successes, of course, was the landmark New START Treaty. I think to the extent the administration would like to engage the Russians in deeper cuts in offensive nuclear forces, it will be unavoidable, it would seem, to not reach some kind of modus vivendi on the missile defense issue. Do you see some potential there? Remember the famous comment that Obama made off mic in Korea that where he said to President Medvedev, please tell Vladimir Vladimirovich, effectively your boss, that I expect to have more flexibility in my second term. Does he have more flexibility? And even if he did have more flexibility, to what extent do you see Vladimir Putin ready to be flexible on this?
Well, Putin has certainly dug himself into a hole on that issue because he's made it into such an issue. How much flexibility does Obama have? You know, as a political matter, not terribly much either. Because for one thing, I think there would be a lot of opposition in this country if he appeared to be too flexible and therefore too concessionary. And there are certain countries in Europe, in particular in Central Europe, that would be absolutely outraged, having been invited to participate by the United States in this undertaking. In some cases, with them not being all that enthusiastic for it, but doing it because they saw in it closer security links with the United States, for the United States again to change its position. And remember, there was a lot of resentment already over the previous change in the character of the systems that was announced abruptly by the United States to the parties involved. So I don't think there's too much flexibility there, except on the level of common sense. We can probably engage in some technological effort to give the Russians a higher degree of confidence that what might be deployed is certainly not usable against them. And if you look at the trajectory of their weapon systems in the event of a collision with the United States, it doesn't go through Romania, and it doesn't go over Poland. It goes towards the Arctic and towards the United States. So I think we could probably contrive some arrangement of technical type to make it absolutely certain that these systems are not usable. I think a larger issue that's bugging the Russians is, of course, the research and development of anti-missile systems in general.
Right.
And I think if that becomes the issue, then perhaps we may be in a better position to exact, if we want to be willing to compromise on that, to exact from the Russians some significant concessions on the levels of weapons and their deployment characteristics, targeting, and so forth. But that gets to be very complicated and very technical, and I don't think it's going to be easy to handle.
I think it's going to be a very, very difficult issue. You know, and for the Russians, I think their relationship with China also comes into play here. Remember when we withdrew from the ABM Treaty in the fall of 2001, and Putin reacted very calmly about it, and there was the cooperation in Afghanistan and another bright moment in U.S.-Russian relations. Beijing was very, very concerned that the Russians were moving in the direction of a closer strategic relationship with the United States. And some kind of compromise for Moscow to make with Washington on missile defense, they have to account for, I think, what Beijing thinks and what Beijing would do.
Well, yes, except that it really depends on whether they think such an arrangement with us involves some sort of a ganging up against them. And I don't think that they are really fearful of that insofar as the military domain is concerned, because there's nothing in their own weapons development and deployments that indicates a high anxiety along these lines. But the most striking thing to me about the Chinese military posture vis-a-vis us or vis-a-vis the Russians is its unilateral self-restraint.
Yeah.
The Chinese acquired the capability to produce nuclear weapons in the 60s. That's 40, 50 years ago. To this day, their deployments directed at us involve an absolutely minimum nuclear deterrent directed at us. I mean, it's literally in the dozens of weapons, several dozens at most, that are capable of hitting us. Whereas we have, I hate to say how many, targeted systems on them. And the same is true of their attitude towards the Russians. I remember an encounter between Deng Xiaoping and President Carter in which I participated. It was a very discreet encounter in which he was discussing with us the Chinese plan to hit Vietnam. And he was anticipating the possibility of a Soviet reaction that could be adverse. And he went through the Chinese options, and they included border incidents that would be intensified, and Deng Xiaoping said, well, we had lots of them already, so a few more would make a difference. Then he talked about perhaps military pressure along the border. Well, we can have incidents all along the border. It's a long border, but we have a lot of people on it, and we can meet the incidents. Then he said, if the Russians decide to engage in a significant military penetration with the armed forces then stationed in Mongolia, pointed towards Beijing, we'll contain it by drowning them in people's war. And then he said, suppose the Russians decide to use their nuclear weapons against us or threaten us. Well, they have many of them, but we have enough to take care of the Bratsk Dam, of maybe Novosibirsk, or maybe, kind of didn't say it explicitly, Moscow. Well, that's just three targets. And he very, I think, rationally calculated that was enough to deter any serious nuclear threat.
Deterrence works.
Yeah. And I don't think the Chinese have given lately any evidence of any significant preoccupation with the Russian nuclear threat, quote unquote, through their own deployments. And they haven't escalated theirs against us.
Let me ask you one more question. Of course, I have lots more, then we'll open it up to the floor, and then we will be concluding in about 15 minutes or so. 5 minutes. Oh, dear. Senator Lugar survived. Welcome, Senator Lugar. Okay, let me open it up to the floor for some questions for Dr. Brzezinski.
Someone will do it.
Please, come to the microphone and identify yourself. And ensure that it is a question and that it is concise.
It's a question.
Thank you.
Back when the Soviet Union did collapse, do you believe that it was a proper thing to do or a mistake when we really kind of rushed right in with NATO and started setting up relationships in the former satellites and have skipped on even now to Georgia to do the same thing? Or was that, do you think, kind of an aggressive move?
Well, first of all, it really wasn't a rush. It wasn't consummated until a decade or so after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the process continued into a second decade. But secondly, I would say that on the whole, this is very positive. You know, good fences make for more compatible neighbors. One can only imagine what the problems would be like today in our relations with the Russians if Latvia or Estonia or Romania or even Poland were in some respects vulnerable to Russian political and military pressure. I think NATO established correctly a certain dividing line, which is compatible with what the Europeans wanted, not only the Europeans living in the countries that I mentioned, but in Europe more generally, because these countries were also at the same time aspirants to membership in a larger European Union. Or could we have a larger European Union in which only its Western neighbors were protected by NATO, but its Eastern members were not? It would be an absurdity. So, in fact, I think NATO is a very significant contribution to stability in Europe. And notice, we haven't had a single problem with Russia over the question of any of these countries being in NATO. Now, not that the fact that residually some Russians may not like it, I can understand it. Of course, they dominated the area, and they're sorry they no longer dominate it. But it makes a lot of difference if they are sorry that they can no longer dominate it, but know that they can't, or if they were sorry they can no longer dominate it and thought that they could. That would not be a good condition. So I think it was actually a contribution to stability in Europe and therefore to a potentially truly stable and maybe eventually cooperative relationship between the West and Russia, and particularly the United States and Russia.
Yes, right here.
Hello. Hello, everybody. I'm Patricia Huffman. I'm a graduate student at Trinity here in D.C. And after Putin, who is coming down the pike as a leader? I know this may be a hard concept, but in a post-Putin world, who would there be and how might they be different with their foreign policy and their domestic policy? Thank you.
Well, I can't obviously give you a name, but it will be someone who in some respects is characteristic of that new, different, increasingly cosmopolitan and West-oriented middle class that's becoming gradually stronger and stronger in Russia. And there'll be someone who, so to speak, partakes and personalizes its aspirations. In that sense, that leader will be very different from Putin. Putin, after all, is a product of the elite institution, but also the most important in the security area institution of the former Soviet Union, the KGB. It's an elite core with a special outlook of its own, which was more intensely exclusive and authoritarian and willing to engage in activities which are not, by and large, consistent with the democratic standards. So he is a product of that system, and it's very hard for him to rise beyond it. It is interesting that both Gorbachev and Yeltsin did, and they were the kind of younger, new products of a decaying communist apparat. But the apparat was never itself as cohesive, as disciplined, as self-exacting as the KGB. So the differences between the new eventual leader and Putin are quite dramatic in terms of their training, personality shaping, world outlook formation, definition of what is a healthy state. I think Putin has a very traditional notion of a healthy state, very much rooted in what I refer to as his historical nostalgia for the imperial past. And look at even the silly trappings that have been adopted in protocol situations in Russia. If you see on television the way the president walks into the assembled apparatchiki waiting to be in his presence, there are these 7-foot-tall soldiers in these comical uniforms, operating dramatically and swinging open the doors, and all of a sudden Putin appears swaggering and so forth. It's a kind of imitation of imperial protocol that really, you know, you makes you think you're watching an Italian operetta rather than a major state in the 21st century.
With the only difference with the Italian operetta is that those people have been waiting for 3 to 4 hours for Putin to show up because
it's
late.
On top of it.
One last question.
Which he does deliberately.
Oh.
Thank you. My name is Kunio Kikuchi, and I'm with Washington Research and Development, and formerly with the World Bank. I see Russia as an enigma because it's a large country, about 50 times the size of Japan, and but its economy is about less than half of Japan today, and so it can do better. I see Russia as two separate countries, one European, not separate countries, but two distinctive areas, one European Russia and the other, let's say, Asian Russia. Dr. Brzezinski, you mentioned Vladivostok and Nakhodka, actually, as the center of Russia in Asia. But I see Vladivostok as the center of, let's say, East Russia, and largely a Pacific, let's say, domain, with the future defined by a very close and complementary ties between China, Korea, and Japan. And I wonder if you had any views on that.
Well, it really does depend on whether Russia makes a success of its obvious interest and understandable interest of retaining its presence in the Far East, symbolized particularly by Vladivostok. And what I said earlier had that in mind, namely, if Russia moves to the West, I think its chances of making Vladivostok its equivalent of our San Francisco or LA increase. If it doesn't, they decrease because the area becomes depopulated while being next door to a highly productive, energetic China, South Korea, Japan, and so forth. So that is the fundamental choice that Russia faces. And this is ultimately why I am a long-term optimist. I think there will be enough Russians to realize that in this day and age, Russia with the West will be far more attractive to its neighbors and far more successful itself than if it tries to be isolated, and particularly if it tries to pursue at the same time an unrealistic, unhistorical, unattainable foreign policy.
Well, I think on that optimistic note, it's an appropriate time to conclude our discussion. You know, San Francisco is my hometown, and San Francisco is Vladivostok's sister city as well. And I can only share your hope that Vladivostok will develop in the direction more like San Francisco than, let's say, Magadan.
Yes, very good point.
But like I said, I share your long-term optimism is big. The trick is how we all get from here to there.
Precisely.
And I guess that's the task that we face.
And therefore, no illusions.
No illusions.
But a perspective.
And some job security. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Folks, sorry, don't go anywhere. I've already committed a major faux pas here on Capitol Hill in keeping a very significant senator waiting. And this is the conclusion of our program. It's a great honor for me also to introduce Senator Richard Lugar from Indiana. The U.S. Senate's most senior Republican and longest-serving member of Congress in Indiana history. A Republican leader in the Foreign Relations Committee and a member and former chairman of the Agricultural, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee, first elected to the Senate in 1976 after a very successful two terms as
mayor of the city of Indianapolis. Senator Lugar has a couple of important ties to CSIS. First of all, when he joined the Navy, he worked for then Chief of Naval Operations R. Lee Burke, who about later was one of the co-founders of CSIS. And the second connection was really probably in what I know in my world Senator Lugar most for, and that's for the tremendous work that he's done in reducing the threat of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. And of course, in 1991, he forged a bipartisan partnership. Remember when bipartisanship existed in Washington, with then Senate Armed Services Chairman Sam Nunn, who of course is the chairman of the board of CSIS now. To destroy weapons of mass destruction in the former Soviet Union, the so-called Nunn-Lugar Act, or Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, which has deactivated more than 7,500 warheads once aimed at the United States. I think by far and away this is the most successful U.S. assistance program to Russia, probably the world's most successful assistance program to Russia, with the greatest benefit for global security and peace around the world. And if I think about the only U.S. assistance program that could compare in this kind of effect, maybe it would be the Marshall Plan. So that's a pretty darn good legacy to think about. And there's one other legacy I'd like to note, because regretfully Senator Lugar will be retiring from the Senate in January. But he's had very, very deep experience in Russia, and he should probably be publicly credited to some extent with President Obama's early education in the country, as then-Senator Obama accompanied Senator Lugar on a trip to the Russian Federation visiting nuclear facilities, and they also went to Ukraine. And one of the results of this trip was a co-sponsored piece of legislation to expand the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program to the field of conventional weapons. So I want to thank you also for your work with Senator Obama. I remember at that time I was directing the Carnegie Moscow Center in Moscow, and I recall that the Russians held your plane on the tarmac for 4 hours for some idiotic bureaucratic reason. And I thought, my God, what are they doing? Russia does not have in many people that would be considered a friend or an advocate or even someone willing to look at Russia in a balanced and objective way. And you are holding one of them on the tarmac in Tomsk right now. That is truly foolish. Ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome to the podium today Senator Richard Lugar.
Well, I thank CSIS for organizing this remarkable program. I thank Andy for his thoughtful introduction and for the great work that he has been doing in bringing education to all of us about Russia and working with my partner, Sam Nunn, who has been mentioned. And it was a great pleasure to hear our near neighbor, Dick Brzezinski, earlier on. We are just a bit through the woods and see each other frequently. And I was telling Dr. Brzezinski as he left that it was my privilege to be in Warsaw last weekend at the European Academy of Diplomacy, where he's an iconic figure, and in ceremonies with students and officials of the Polish government on that occasion, which reminded me a great deal of his heritage and his work. Let me start by saying simply that the United States relationship with Russia remains critical to many United States foreign policy priorities, including nuclear nonproliferation, counterterrorism, global energy security, and numerous regional issues in Eurasia. And although common interests and economic conditions have created openings for cooperation in specific areas, we must proceed according to a realistic assessment of what is possible and avoid ratcheting our attitude toward Russia between severe disappointment and excessive expectations. Indeed, despite some concrete achievements, we must deal with reality that United States-Russian relations will often be strained. Russia remains in non-compliance with its 2008 ceasefire obligations in Georgia. Russia's heavy-handed use of its energy predominance over Ukraine, Moldova, Belarus, and the Baltic states demonstrates that Moscow has not altered its hard line on regional issues. And we frequently face reflexive Russian opposition to the United States in the UN Security Council on issues such as Syria, Iran, and others in recent times. Now, this conference is particularly timely as the United States Senate may soon commence floor debate on an aspect of the relationship that often receives too little consideration, namely our economic ties. Authorization of permanent normal trade relations with Russia would be a very important milestone. And I am hopeful that the Russian WTO membership would spur sorely needed reforms in its trade and investment climate. This year alone, an astonishing $70 billion in capital is expected to flee Russia. And by one estimate, Russian assets suffer a devaluation of up to 30% due solely to the political risk created by Russian leadership. I'm pleased that the so-called PNTR bill passed in the House of Representatives also includes the Sergei Magnitsky Act, a measure that appears increasingly necessary as Moscow continues a disconcerting campaign against dissent, whether by musicians, journalists, or young lawyers. The upcoming Senate debate is likely to focus on whether to globalize the Magnitsky Act or to maintain a Russian-specific focus, as in the version passed by the House. Even as our economic relationship may soon be bolstered through PNTR, I would like to focus my comments on nuclear security cooperation, a long-standing and fundamental aspect of our policy toward Russia that finds itself under considerable strain presently. I would begin by noting that windows have defined much of Russian history. In the time of Peter the Great, Russia was in search of its, quote, windows on the West, as Russia sought to reform itself through the 17th and 18th centuries. During the Cold War, Paul Nitze warned of a, quote, window of vulnerability, end of quote, as the Soviet Union began its nuclear buildup. I've spoken for many years about the window of opportunity that was utilized at the end of the Cold War. It was an opportunity to become a partner with Russia on a range of issues, but in particular in joint safeguards and elimination of the most dangerous weapons in the world. During the last two decades, the so-called Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program was a vehicle in which the United States seized this opportunity of nuclear cooperation. More than 20 years later, it is easy to forget the enormity of the proliferation challenge that we faced. One needs only to witness the Russian SS-18 ballistic missiles being cut up at Surovatica, the dismantlement of a Typhoon ballistic missile submarine at Sevmash facility, to understand the approaches to the Barents Sea, to understand the dangers that were presently all over the continent. But the Nunn-Lugar program has been a triumph measured in far more than the numbers of missiles, warheads, chemical agents, and biological pathogens now under lock and key or destroyed. It also has become a day-to-day enterprise involving thousands of Americans and Russian policymakers, technicians, and military personnel learning to work together on mundane engineering challenges, equipment and supply logistics, and legal frameworks. It's also no small feat that Nunn-Lugar has helped pry open Russian military and weapons of mass destruction complexes, among the most inscrutable and closed elements of Russian society, and exposed them to international safety standards. Unfortunately, many aspects of this relationship have come under considerable strain recently. One tenet of the Nunn-Lugar program is being called into question in part by a Russian demand to renegotiate the terms of the so-called umbrella agreement, rather than simply renew or extend the terms that have served as the legal basis of nuclear cooperation for 20 years. In particular, efforts on the ground in Russia to destroy strategic offensive missiles have been singled out in recent diplomatic discussions. The continuation of our work on strategic offensive arms elimination remains the backbone of our non-nuclear efforts in Russia. Indeed, this type of weapons elimination is the primary reason for having the umbrella agreement. If we terminate this specific type of elimination program in Russia, I'm concerned that the rationale for the entire non-nuclear program in Russia and the utility of the umbrella agreement itself might disappear. In the coming year, it is not only the non-nuclear umbrella that may expire, but also the agreement to purchase highly enriched uranium from Russia, called the HEU Purchase Agreement. Russia has also recently decided at the International Science and Technology Center, a multinational forum of scientific collaboration in Moscow, should be shuttered. Although a great deal of work has been done to move the ISTC to Kazakhstan, there is no information on future projects. In light of these events, it is worth asking, is the window closing again? Now, of course, non-nuclear is not the only forum for non-proliferation engagement with Russia. For example, I championed Senate passage of the New START Treaty, which occupies an important but specific place in our strategic relationship. Coupled with modest weapons cuts, the New START Treaty focuses on transparency, predictability, and stability through its 18 weapons inspections annually on each side. The problem is that if non-nuclear, ISTC, and the HEU Purchase Agreement are all allowed to expire, or even to be so-called reset, New START and its bilateral commissions could become the only vehicle for strategic dialogue with Russia and the sole vessels to contain our inevitable disagreements and struggles on arms control and non-proliferation issues. In effect, we'd be reverting back to the old days when the primary means of strategic engagement we had with Russia was under the ABM Treaty's Special Consultative Commission. The Obama administration needs to engage at the highest levels to ensure the future success of our non-proliferation efforts with Russia. And I would suggest that termination of our strategic offensive arms elimination efforts in Russia might only embolden future opposition to the non-nuclear model. We must execute a more sustained negotiation strategy with Moscow if we're to continue the successes of non-nuclear with a dramatic follow-on agreement, while preserving the necessary legal and fiscal safeguards for American contractors who undertake the non-nuclear work. Now, all too often, present difficulties are allowed to distract from the work of arms control and nuclear cooperation. One does not have to abandon frustrations with the Russian government or dismiss contentious policy disagreements with Moscow to invest in the practical enterprises of nuclear verification, confidence building, and weapons dismantlement with Moscow. In fact, it's precisely the friction in our broader relationship that makes the work so important. I would point out that, as a matter of fact, we are now at a standstill with regard to discussions on the umbrella agreement. But parenthetically, I would mention that a recent trip to Russia brought about at least conversation that Russians want to continue discussing this. They want to have this avenue of agreement. And I would add one final footnote, that in a trip to Surovatica, where missiles are still being cut apart, and where a Russian senator greeted me at the airport and wanted to accompany me out there, we had lunch in the midst of missiles, literally, the pieces and parts were all around us. And for the folks out in Surovatica, it was no longer a question of Moscow, it was a jobs issue. They want to continue cutting up a missile a month for many years to come. And so, happily, we would like to cooperate with them. As a matter of fact, the world will be much safer if all of us prosper in that respect. I thank you so much for your attention. I apologize for all of our roll call votes, and I thank you for your patience in listening for this message. Thank you very much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's always good to conclude on an optimistic note. Let me express my thanks to Senator Lugar, Dr. Brzezinski, Ambassador Hills, and Congressman Smith for their participation and for yours today. I think clearly there are challenges ahead in this relationship, but let's hope at least that we will have a Christmas present in the relationship, and that will be the granting of permanent normal trade relations status to Russia before the holidays. And then we'll have a lot of work to do afterwards with in the new year with the relationship. Thanks very much for coming.